Central bank digital currencies, digital IDs, artificial intelligence, and big tech surveillance. What does our digital future really look like? Join me, Alastair Harding, for a look into our digital future every Wednesday on Paul Brennan's Breakfast Show, right here on Reality Check Radio. Good morning and welcome to another edition of Our Digital Future on Reality Check Radio. My name is Alastair Harding, and in the last two episodes of Our Digital Future, we heard from Aaron Day and G. Edward Griffin. It was Aaron Day who told us very clearly about how the digital system that awaits us includes something called tokenization, which will be used to turn our personal assets into digital assets, which could then be potentially used to coerce and control us alongside CBDCs and digital IDs. And then last week, it was G. Edward Griffin who explained that all of this is no coincidence, that since the early 1900s, when central banking was established with the forming of the US Federal Reserve, the entire money system has been run in a cartel-like manner. And so this digital system based on digital currency is simply the natural progression. And further to all of that, for a couple of months now, we've been talking with a range of other experts about the digital control and surveillance devices that have been deployed supposedly for our own safety with all of this. And you can hear all of those interviews in the replay section of the RCR app and website at www.realitycheck.radio. All you need to do is use the search function to look for Our Digital Future. So as further background to this story, today I have with me Andrew Lowenthal, who was one of the independent journalists who worked with Matt Taibbi to break the Twitter files stories. Among those was the incredible story of the Virality Project, which openly put in place the US government-sponsored censorship machine that sought to suppress COVID information and anti-vaccine sentiment. The story is a chilling one, in which private organizations worked with government bodies to censor even true information. That was a fact that they even admitted to. And therefore, it is yet another example of why the digitization of our future is so troubling to many of us. And for Andrew Lowenthal, it was enough for him to want to do something about it. So he set up a new organization he calls LibreNet, which he's spoken about with Paul Brennan previously on the RCR Breakfast Show. And you can find LibreNet at liber-net.org. That's liber-net.org. And its purpose is countering digital authoritarianism. And so that's what Andrew's here to talk with us about today. So welcome, Andrew. Thank you for joining us on Our Digital Future on Reality Check Radio. Can you start perhaps by articulating what is LibreNet and what are you trying to achieve with it?
So LibreNet is a digital civil liberties initiative that I started about a year ago. And essentially, I'm trying to raise awareness of the growth of digital authoritarianism, particularly to people in the progressive digital free expression world, which is where I came from, who I think in many respects have actually become part of the problem because they've turned against the original mission, as I understood it, which was to support online free speech and be against digital controls from governments. And that mission seems to have changed to protecting people from bad information. And there is bad information out there and disinformation, etc. But this has opened the door to a lot of bad actors to essentially, you know, try to censor content and censor platforms for their own particular political interests. So that's one of the things that I'm trying to do across a variety of different other issues as well. But that's really the core aspect of it.
On Our Digital Future, over the past few weeks, we've been talking a lot about CBDCs and also digital IDs. And I notice on your website for LibreNet, you talk about your main areas of concern. You say that it's the expansion of censorship, the digital surveillance regimes, also the technologies that coerce and control like CBDCs, and also digital IDs that store biometric data and potentially exclude people from society. So what sort of future are you seeing that makes you want to set up LibreNet? What, with all we know about digital censorship and what we've discovered over the past few years, and we'll get into the Twitter files that precipitated a lot of this in a few moments, but what do CBDCs and digital IDs represent for our future?
Well, they represent an enormous amount of possible government and corporate control over our financial sovereignty, essentially over our kind of personal sovereignty and independence, because you can, you know, essentially program them to allow or disallow certain things. I mean, it was very interesting, perhaps an understatement, a few weeks ago when there was the Microsoft update error. And, you know, the planes couldn't fly and people couldn't go to the shops and et cetera, all for some tiny line of code, apparently, that was some kind of problem. So that means if you want to kind of use these switches, and in many other parts of the world, these kind of switches are used in places like India or Sri Lanka and others where there's unrest, you know, the government will switch off the internet, or they'll switch off WhatsApp, or they'll switch off different aspects of the communications system, and it gives the government an enormous amount of control. Now, the world that I inhabited for more than 20 years, which is often referred to as the digital rights movement, was very concerned about these internet shutdowns. It was all progressive people, everyone, half the people look like they're from libs of TikTok, all really concerned when the internet got shut down in Nepal or Madagascar or wherever it might be, like completely against this and willing to, I guess, you know, deal with a certain amount of trade-offs in terms of, okay, the civil unrest might take a little bit longer to put down, but the kind of freedom of internet access and communication is more important. I mean, now that space essentially would have the opposite effect. I imagine now with the, say, the unrest that is happening in the UK, many of those people would be, well, okay, if we have to switch off the internet for a few days to, or WhatsApp or Telegram or whatever it is to contain this, then actually we're going to back the government to do it. So part of the issue is just that the civil society that was there to kind of fight against a lot of this stuff has collapsed in the face of it. And so that's what a lot of what I'm trying to do, because I can still talk to a lot of that space, because that's what, that's the space that I inhabited for so long. And there's just more and more coming down the pipeline. So the exciting thing is there's a whole bunch of new people who 5 years ago probably weren't looking at these issues so much. They thankfully didn't impact them very much, who now are very switched on to what is going on. But those two groups of people, to oversimplify it, are culturally quite different as well.
I find it kind of odd that, you know, as you say, that the people that we're talking about in the past, for some reason, have forgotten all about it, and they're actually on the other side of things now. It's almost like it's the personification of the power corrupts saying that we have.
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, because some of it's organic and some of it's not organic. I mean, the main reason that I can see is that people essentially swap safety for freedom and went, well, there's hate speech, there's disinformation, these are bigger threats and this is more important. We're willing to justify our freedom in order to deal with these other threats, which again is a complete opposite, say, of the war on terror, where it was actually people on the left who were saying, you know, actually we're willing to risk getting on a plane that might be that might not land again, and willing to in exchange for preserving our civil liberties. I mean, it's completely flipped on its head, but I think it's because of kind of issues around hate speech, minority rights, disinformation, and these are the things that are considered needed to protect them. Whereas actually I would say, if you're interested in kind of the rights of minorities, free speech is your best friend. And it might not always be the most reliable friend, but in times of trouble, this is the thing that you're really, really going to want.
Do they not see that these machines that are being built, these censorship machines and the likes of CBDCs and digital IDs, which will control and surveil us and manipulate us, do the people that are championing them today not see how they could potentially end up on the wrong side of them in the future?
Well, I mean, there's different people. So I think the people who are really pushing them, I wouldn't say this kind of digital right, progressive digital rights world is really pushing like CBDCs and other things, although a lot of them are quite open to things like digital ID from what I've seen. They're more that they're meant to be the people who are kind of a bulwark against kind of government and corporate overreach that have decided oftentimes to stand on the side of government and corporate interests instead of on the side of the population at large. They see the threats as coming from somewhere else, or they've been seduced into seeing the threats as coming from somewhere else, coming from what they would conceive as the far right or anti-vaxxers or whatever kind of idea they've kind of latched onto. At the same time, there's a ton of people in that space who see the problem as well and are really concerned about this drift off into something that looks much, much more authoritarian. I mean, I met with 7 or 8 progressive journalists in Sydney last week, and these were all people who were like, yeah, something kind of weird has happened, and all of the kind of objective journalism has become advocacy journalism and is not critical, properly critical, and we're concerned about free speech and we're concerned about cancel culture. So there's lots of people in there, but they're all, I mean, the kind of cancel culture stuff is much more directed at kind of internally at political rivals within the progressive space than it is directed at people on the right. The whole point of it is to allow one group to ascend, one faction, say, of the of progressives to ascend into a leadership position and control and to exclude the other. So it's much more kind of interscene kind of warfare than it is kind of directed at people on the right. So there's lots of people in the progressive space who are like, I'm copying it because I just asked a question about the voice referendum, or, you know, if you were a good progressive, you just weren't even allowed to ask a question about. So, and they're kind of going, this is crazy. Like I should be able to ask a question at least without being called a X, Y, and Z. So there's a lot of people in that space who are not happy about where things are at. So I think sometimes people on the outside are going, oh, it's one whole big blob of people, but there's a lot of fractures in it, and it's kind of held together with bubblegum and string, I would actually say.
So is there a chance that the tide is turning, perhaps, that maybe it may seem insurmountable at the moment, but there is a light at the end of the tunnel, there is a dawn coming over the horizon or something?
Well, I'm not sure I can paint you such a rosy picture of a new dawn rising, but I can tell you that there's certainly dissent in the ranks, and I think it's growing. And, you know, there are many a pundit out there who will call peak woke, but I'm not going to be so brave or stupid, maybe it would be, to attempt to do that. But there's definitely a lot of unhappy people who think that things have gone off the rails and are going in the wrong direction. And they're not, I don't know if they're the majority or not, but there's definitely a strong minority there.
Okay, I want to talk about the so-called wrong direction and the stuff which concerns a lot of people who tune into our digital future. And one of those things is, you know, the censorship. And I suppose the whole CBDC and digital ID discussion stems from all out the fears of the censorship industrial complex, so to speak. And of course, one of the biggest stories of that is something that you were intimately involved with, the Twitter files. And the one that I remember specifically is the story of the Virality Project. To me, this was a massive moment. You know, I remember during the COVID era, people would say to me, oh, don't talk rubbish. You know, how could they control what people are saying on a global scale and have everybody saying the same thing? And I remember thinking at the time, well, that is hard to imagine. I can't quite work out how they do that. But this is how they did it, wasn't it? The Virality Project. And was this an aha moment for you as well?
I would say it was, because when I was watching, experiencing the response to COVID unfold, there was something just obviously very strange going on. That was like something very, very up in the information environment that I cannot really put my finger on. Things just don't seem to be behaving in the normal way. If, you know, if my model was, say, Iraq War, you know, 2003, and what government propaganda looked like then, there was a kind of, it was kind of an industrial broadcast model of public opinion management. And things were just topsy-turvy. And again, like at the start, we were saying it before we hit the record button, I believed pretty much everything for the first 3 months and then kind of slowly walked it back from there. So I was in no way, you know, immune to this. But eventually I was like, there's just something very, very strange going on. So I wouldn't say, and I'll explain to you the Rally Project in much as, but I wouldn't say it was the kind of be all and end all, because there are other very important initiatives like the Trusted News Initiative as well. But it's arguable that for the social media space, this was the most important project, at least that people have been able to discover so far. So what was the Virality Project? So the Virality Project began actually something called the Election Integrity Partnership. And this was, in fact, an initiative of the Department of Homeland Security. There's a counterterrorism body that was set up in the wake of 9/11. There's an email from a man named Graham Brookie from the Atlantic Council, where he emails his colleagues and says, we've just been asked to set up an election integrity partnership by the Department of Homeland Security and CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which sits within Department of Homeland Security. Three other partners joined that initiative. One was Stanford Internet Observatory, and the research director there, Renee DiResta, was literally introduced by her boss, Alex Samos, as having, quote, worked for the CIA. So the University of Washington was another academic institution, and another organization called Graphica, which is kind of an advanced digital mapping business, essentially, that, you know, has a lot of entanglements with the kind of military industrial complex, basically contracts from the Air Force, contracts with DARPA, et cetera, but also do work for groups like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. You can just go to their website and they proudly mix and match their clients and advertise them to you. And then there was a couple more academic institutions that were added on to the Virality Project as well. So because the Virality Project basically immediately followed after this election integrity partnership, they used the same kind of internal ticketing system to flag content. And they had the same partners in terms of the kind of civil society partners. And they also had the same partners on the big tech side, which included Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, Pinterest, Google, YouTube, you know, Instagram, WhatsApp, et cetera. So they had, you know, partner level access at the absolute highest level in Twitter. And so we could, well, almost at the highest level, we didn't see emails with, say, Jack Dorsey on there, but with people like Joel Roth and Nick Pickles, who were head of trust and safety and et cetera. And so you'd have to assume that they were talking to other people at these other platforms at very similar levels, be a reasonable assumption, I think. So, and the other thing is that Stanford Internet Observatory, who had an agreement with Twitter to pull out 50 million COVID-related tweets per day. So they could essentially like map that, a pipeline out of Twitter that essentially allowed them to completely map the conversation that was happening on Twitter. Imagine the kind of heat maps and kind of swarms of conversation that you could look at if you had that level of data and you pass it through machine learning systems. So you can see the nodes, you can see who's kind of leading conversations, where the kind of battles are being fought in this kind of information warfare. And they also had, apart from this DHS, Department of Homeland Security, level of relationship, you know, Surgeon General, White House Surgeon General Murphy, you know, he opened or helped the Virality Project launch one of their initiatives. So they're literally connected to the White House, to the one of the biggest intelligence agencies in the United States, to top levels of, you know, some of the biggest, almost all the biggest platforms, maybe apart from LinkedIn, and they are flagging content to those platforms. What are they flagging? So, in their guidance, which is one of the things that we found, they were telling platforms to consider true stories of vaccine side effects as misinformation. And so this was literally their definition of misinformation.
This part is absolutely crazy to me, because to actually make the leap from, I think I'm doing a good thing by protecting society and moderating or censoring the conversation, mm-hmm. to, I know that's truth, and so I'm going to censor it anyway. But that's a leap of ideology. It's a very anti-human kind of leap to make, don't you think?
Well, I imagine if I was to be play devil's advocate and try and go into bat for them, and assume the best of intentions, then their argument would be, well, you know, if these stories get out, then people won't get vaccinated, and the vaccines are great, and more people will die. So that's how they would justify what they are doing from a moral standpoint.
But the stories that the reference we're talking about here are stories about people who had been hurt by the vaccines.
They had. So I'm going to give you an example there. So there was a girl, 12-year-old girl at the time called Maddie DeGarry.
Yes.
His parents enrolled her in the Pfizer trial for the COVID mRNA vaccine shot. And she was injured in that trial. There are multiple doctor's letters, discharge letters that I saw that say, you know, this was a result of a vaccine injury. The people who are running the Virality Project, the kind of flaggers who were put on the job of scouring the internet, were flagging her to the social media partners and saying, this can't be true, what these posts are saying, which included many sometimes mainstream media reports in kind of local news in the United States, because the dates don't line up with Moderna's teenage or child vaccine trial. But she was now in the Moderna trial. She was in the Pfizer trial. So either that was complete incompetence or something worse, because literally the stuff that they logged inside those tickets or inside the kind of flags were Pfizer, and then, oh, the Moderna dates don't line up, so this can't be true. So this is either the kind of level of competence. But also the thing is, even if they said, well, it's the Pfizer trial, da da da, they don't have medical qualifications. And they've determined what's true and false. And they haven't gone and investigated. They haven't contacted the DeGarry family and said, is this story really true? Do you have kind of some documentation, da da da? They've just gone, you know, I think most of these people are kind of, no offense to 20-something kind of interns that they had scouring the internet for this stuff. And they've just kind of gone, oh, we don't think this is true.
You went through all of these files from the inside Twitter, right?
So some of it was from Twitter. So the kind of true stories to vaccine side of sex was from going through the Twitter files with that was a document that I actually found with Matt Taibbi. But the tickets that I'm referring to, these flags, came about as a result of something called the House Committee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government, which is a US congressional committee that subpoenaed these documents from Stanford under total duress. They were really, we did not want to release them, and in the end had to hand them over. So you literally can see all the things. We basically went through all the things that they logged and were flagging out to all these social media partners. So the story of Maddie DeGarry comes from not from the Twitter files, but from documents that were released to this House Committee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government.
So in any of those emails or the discussions that they were having, did anybody express reservations about what they were doing?
Well, I mean, well, the thing is that there were different discussions within Twitter, and Twitter did definitely push back on some stuff, and not all the stuff that was being flagged got taken down. So in the Election Integrity Partnership that led to the Virality Project, they made quite specific recommendations, take this down, label this, etc. In the Virality Project, they weren't quite as explicit. So they didn't say censor this person. They just said, look at this, look at this, look at this. I mean, you've also got to ask, why do these billion-dollar companies need to outsource content moderation and content flagging? Surely they have enough people internally. Well, and I think the answer to that question is because this was essentially an initiative that was set up by the government. But you know, the partners in that never revealed this came from the government, and this is part of the Murphy versus Missouri suit that you may have looked at as well, whereby people like Jay Bhattacharya, Aaron Cariardi, Martin Kulldorff are suing the White House and other parts of the government for essentially First Amendment violations. And Virality Project is one of the main things that they are pointing to in terms of government involvement in censorship. So the new system, though, what it looks like is the censorship gets kind of laundered through these kind of progressive-looking NGOs and academic institutions that seem like they're trying to do something nice, because some of them are trying to do something nice. There are anti-disinformation organizations out there that I think are reasonably well-intentioned, are not kind of fairly organic in terms of like the people running them. They're not kind of particularly manipulated from the government or corporations, et cetera, et cetera. But within that same mix, there's all these ones that are essentially kind of shilling for the government, or in many cases, like the Verily Project, actually set up by the government and pretended to be independent.
And I think that's kind of the genius of what I see it anyway, from where I look. And I think Virality Project's been disbanded now, hasn't it?
So the whole Stanford Internet Observatory has been massively scaled back. I mean, essentially has been kind of merged into its parent organization at Stanford. So Renee Diresta did not have her contract renewed, and several of the other staff also didn't have their contract renewed. So that project, yeah, is essentially over. And that is a result of a huge amount of attention, essentially, that was brought to bear upon it.
Well, the point that I was going to make was that these organizations that make up this, and I've seen you call it before in one of your stories, the lying machine. We're talking about fact checkers like PolitiFact and other organizations like NewsGuard, and even the media itself that run the PR for all of it. That to me is what the lying machine perhaps is all of this group of private organizations, which perhaps give the government, the US government and other governments around the world, the plausible deniability because it's privately funded. It's outside of the democratic system. Mm.
Some of it is government funded, but they have to hide it. So probably, and we don't think we have fully the full evidence to say this, but it's a reasonable hypothesis. There's a good chance that some of the money came from a National Science Foundation grant for the Virality Project. So it is in there, and there's huge amounts of money that do go into anti-disinformation organizations from the government, such as from the Global Engagement Center. And it is where the really, really big money is. But just to go back to your point more, which is what is kind of new, and what you're saying is quite correct, is that actually the censorship has kind of been put inside these nice sounding, nice looking organizations that seem like they're there to help society. And that's what was so shocking for me, whereby all this kind of NGO world, it's all kind of fluffy and freedom of expression and we want to make the world a better place, et cetera, et cetera, is where a lot of these initiatives were kind of basing themselves out of, the kind of inorganic as well as the organic ones. And to kind of see, oh, that's weird, I know that person. What are they doing here in this email chain with, you know, all of these other initiatives from Twitter or in conversation with the government or whatever it might be? And that's quite tough for a lot of people in that space because they're like, well, I also know those people. I know those initiatives and I have my kind of identity bound up with this whole field. And you're now telling me that it's corrupt. And I'm like, yes, that is what I'm telling you. There's a lot of corruption in there. And we need to kind of get with the program about that and weed it out.
Is there an answer in which perhaps we break up all of this? I mean, we have these giant government-sponsored censorship machines, and as well as that, we've got the likes of Google, which manipulates us and censors us. We talked with Dr. Robert Epstein in our first episode of Our Digital Future about that and his research into that. And it's quite horrifying, the amount of manipulation that goes on with Google. But they're not the only ones. They're also the other social media giants. They do the same thing. And then they're working together with governments as well. So is it a case of breaking it up? And if so, how do we break it up?
I think there are a whole bunch of different options, I think, out there. I mean, I would definitely support, you know, antitrust legislation that would, you know, separate Google from YouTube, from, you know, other components of the alphabet megalith, and the same for, you know, breaking up Facebook and separating Instagram from WhatsApp from the other parts of the platform. I mean, the same would go from X if, you know, Elon Musk wants to kind of put in digital payments, et cetera, et cetera. I do not think that should be allowed either. You need to create a whole new ecosystem, essentially, in the digital space, because what you have now is a quite cozy relationship between big tech and the government where, you know, there are half a dozen, maybe 10, 12 at best companies that control a huge percentage of the digital ecosystem. And if the government wants something done, it goes to them. And again, this is from exchanges with, say, Nick Clegg at Facebook, where you can literally see that he's making a compromise and saying, well, we kind of need this from the government, and we think this might violate the First Amendment, but we're going to have to do it because otherwise we won't get that deal. And, you know, it's much easier for the government to deal with half a dozen or a dozen mega corporations than it is for them to deal with kind of ecosystem of hundreds of thousands of independent platforms and initiatives. So I think breaking them up is definitely key. But again, you've got there's a cozy relationship there that somehow needs to be quite radically disrupted. And I think that will solve quite a lot of the problem, is having a much kind of fairer marketplace of options in terms of platforms. But, you know, and then there are other options that are more at the ground level. I mean, one of people say, well, what can I do to support free speech? And my refrain is, speak freely. You have a tongue, you have a mouth, you have a voice. What this whole system is trying to do is to get you to bite your tongue. And that doesn't mean you should be abrasive and rude and et cetera, et cetera. In fact, that's probably going to be completely counterproductive. But that means if you have a reasonable thought on your mind or you're exploring an idea, say it. Because everyone, we're in this new kind of Soviet, so I kind of imagine like living in the Soviet Union might have been, where everyone's kind of waiting for permission to think and speak and not quite sure, you know, can I say this or can I not say that? And someone says it, says, oh, okay, we're allowed to say that now. But that is not how conversation worked 10 years ago. I think people spoke way, way, way more freely in Western countries 10 years ago. Now, it looks to me, I lived in Thailand for 3.5 years, and it feels like that, where people had to bring up the topic of the king came up in Thailand, everyone would kind of, you know, look side to side, see how far away other people might be on the table, maybe put their phones somewhere else and start having a conversation about, you know, what was really going on. And I would never imagine that would happen in Western societies. I thought that you know, there were definitely some problems, but I hadn't thought that we would start doing that.
Yeah, but the frightening part of that example is that in Thailand, there are laws that govern how you speak about the king. That's why those people look over their shoulders.
Yeah.
Whereas in our Western society, there are no laws that govern such things that tell us we can't speak our minds. In fact, we have rights written into our laws saying that we can speak our minds freely, yet somehow we feel like we can't and we have to self-censor ourselves. That's the frightening part, isn't it?
Yeah, you don't. It's true. You don't even need the 20-year Les Majest laws on the books. People are kind of scared enough of the kind of wrath of social opinion that they will keep themselves quiet.
So bringing it back to our digital future subject, which is largely about CBDCs and digital IDs and the coercive control systems that we expect are put in around those. Are these the sorts of stories, these stories about censorship that we're talking about today, is this just a taste of what is to come? Is this what they're putting in place around us?
Well, they'll just have more leverage to do it. And you can imagine now with, say, again, this kind of unrest that is happening in the UK, if there's no physical money, well, you can just switch. You facially recognize someone at the protest, and you go, okay, well, we're just going to cancel your bank account or suspend your ability to do digital payments. You can't get back until you come down and report to the police station. But what if you're just an ordinary citizen that was walking past and you weren't in the, well, even if you were at the protest, it's a problem. But what if you also weren't and you just kind of get swept up and can't go and pick your daughter up from school or, you know, whatever it might be, this kind of dragnet style of policing that you can imagine these systems are going to enable. And then as soon as there's a crisis, people can't help but roll these kind of tools out. They don't sit on the shelf, essentially. So, yeah, I think that, again, the difficult thing is, why is it so much of a challenge at the moment to get people to recognize that this is a real problem, that they see the threat of the unrest as much, much more troubling, and it is a problem, than you know, the government having all this power. And maybe because we haven't been through something like this for a long time in Western societies, we've had fairly functional governments, were a bit naive about where things could actually end up.
Okay, so we've run out of time. So this is our last question. I'd like to ask you, why freedom of speech and why digital freedom is so important to you? Why are these discussions about our digital future so important? I mean, I look at freedom of speech and I think to myself, well, the reason it's so important is because freedom of speech is about the testing of ideas. It's about putting idea A up against idea B and testing it and finding out which is the good idea and which is the bad idea. And if we don't do that, we're human beings, we make mistakes, right? So we'll probably end up destroying ourselves. And in that respect, I think of it that I think it's as important as food, water, and warmth to human life. But why are these discussions about our digital freedom and freedom of speech, why are they so important to you?
It is your protection against tyranny. If you cannot speak, then you are at the mercy of your masters. And it also produces ineffective as a form of rule. Free speech is a way that ideas are tested and tried and proven or disproven, or consensus is built. You have a conversation, if you have a society, a country where the conversation is, you know, manipulated and censored, etc., you don't come up with solutions to that society's problems at all, or if you do, much, much more slowly. And the problems can just kind of accelerate and go off the rails, and very, very bad things can happen. So free speech is not perfect. It can be coarse. People can be rude. It can be disruptive, etc. But the alternative is far, far worse than the discomfort that hearing unpopular or unwelcome ideas is. So it's really just, it is absolutely baked into success of our societies. The societies that I think respect free speech tend to be much more successful economically, socially, than those that suppress it.
That's Andrew Lowenthal, one of the independent journalists who helped Matt Taibbi break the Twitter files stories. And he's also the founder of Libernet, a journalism initiative meant to help counter digital authoritarianism. And if you're interested in reading or hearing more from Andrew, please do visit his website, where you'll find his writing and links to his Substack account and his work with Racket News and his Twitter account as well. And you'll find that website at www.liber-net.org. That's liber-net.org. Over these past few weeks, we've heard a lot about the dangers of digital IDs and digital currencies. And we've discovered that there are many reasons to indeed think of them as dangerous to our freedom. But also what I've taken from this subject is the silence around it, how disinterested the mainstream media are in this topic, and how, despite two friendly emails to the Reserve Bank to request somebody to come on and speak about the topic, I've received no reply. Not even a thanks, but no thanks. Which is funny, because they've spoken about it with other media, so I do know that they want to get their message out. And I emphasized to them that I was hoping to get their message to balance the interviews we've already done, and maybe quell the fears of some of the New Zealanders they serve. But it seems they're not interested in that, which is a shame, because as Andrew Lowenthal just pointed out to us, it's highly possible that many of the journalists and central bankers who drive the CBDC message think they're actually doing humanity a favor. But who could tell if they won't test their ideas in any meaningful way? And so I guess that the silver lining to all of this is that at RCR, we're left with the story of the century all to ourselves, of the redesign of the global monetary system and the power grab that it entails. And you can hear it all on the RCR app and on the website in the replay section. Just click on the magnifying glass icon and do a search for Our Digital Future, and you'll find all 12 episodes that I've done alongside others from our other hosts as well. And then perhaps you'll feel informed enough to go and talk to your friends and family about it too. and we at RCR will have done our job. My name is Alastair Harding, and you've been listening to Our Digital Future only on Reality Check Radio.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.